Maybe you've seen the Coen brothers' 1998 film, The Big Lebowski. Devoted fans believe the more often you view it, the more you'll become attached to the movie. The film's legion of fans meets for a yearly convention at a bowling alley in Louisville. Many dress like the dude, played by Jeff Bridges, or like Walter, played by John Goodman. Believe it or not, there's now a 400-page scholarly book about the film. In January, I talked to one of the contributors, Craig Owens, professor of English at Drake University. He wrote the chapter on the drink, The White Russian.
Craig, you have an essay in the year's work in Lebowski studies. What is there, about 50 essays in this book, I suppose?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I would imagine a lot of people are surprised to know that this book exists. An academic book on a film that's hard to describe. How would you describe the film?
Well, it seems to me that the film is, it's certainly not a celebration of academic life, that's
no,
for sure,
no.
Or the rigors of employment at all. It's really a, kind of a, an homage to tuning out and to getting out of the rat race or to getting out of the high-pressure environments of work, of economy, of money-making and spending money. It is surprising, as you say, that a film like The Big Lebowski is attracts critical attention, especially 10 years after it was made. So I understand your sense of surprise about that.
It's funny, I often will say The Great Lebowski, too, and I'm trying to think why that is. Apparently you do that once in a while, too. Great Gatsby, maybe, or something slipping in?
Yeah, you know, because there, maybe that's it. It's also that on one of the later releases of the film, there was a satirical or kind of spurious introduction given by a fictitious film producer and a restorer, and in it he claims to have discovered the only remaining copy of the film The Big Lebowski, but he found it in Italian, he claims, in which it was called Le Grand Lebowski. I guess I was thinking of The Grand Lebowski when I said The Great Lebowski, when in fact it's The Big Lebowski. So it seems like I was unconsciously taken in by the little joke at the beginning of the collector's release of the film.
Yeah. So many people love and adore this film, and it's you run into people, and some people you would never expect, who have seen this 10, 15, 20 times and are always happy to see it again. How many times have you seen it?
I haven't seen it 15 times. Over my life, I've probably seen it 5 or 6 times in its entirety, and then, you know, occasionally in bits and pieces when it's been on some television or somebody's VCR or DVD player, but certainly not 15 times.
When you look the book up on a library catalog under Big Lebowski, I noticed the Library of Congress classification, the first line that comes up is slackers / drama. And I don't see the dude as a slacker first and foremost. Do you?
Well, I think that's where the cult appeal comes from. That is, my sense is that it's because of the sense that he doesn't take anything very seriously that people find his character so refreshing. But I don't think Slacker totally covers every aspect of his character. It seems to me that there are certain things he does take seriously. You know, he's an avid bowler. He took his rug, which tied the whole room together, and which gets stolen at the beginning of the film. Not stolen, but damaged at the very beginning of the film, very seriously. So when he gets crossed, he's willing to rise to the occasion to do what he needs to do to get, you know, get what he wants. So I'm not sure, as you said, I'm not sure Slacker entirely describes his character. I think it's probably his preferred state. It might be his default mode. If everything is, you know, is easygoing, if his landlord isn't bugging him for money, if somebody hasn't involved him in a mock kidnapping that he's basically fraudulently blackmailed into taking part in solving, I think yes, he would just be a slacker. but because we see aspects of his character that allow him to take action, albeit often misguided or wrong-headed action, I would agree with you on that point.
Yeah. Joel and Ethan Coen's movie, The Big Lebowski, now we're discussing the book, The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. Craig Owens, who teaches at Drake University, has an essay in the book. When you read an academic book like this of 400 and some pages about basically a comedy, that we love the comedy, but you learn some things probably about the movie that you didn't realize even if you've seen it a dozen times. When you went through the book, Craig, what did you learn that you hadn't thought about before?
Well, one essay that I remember that jumped out at me was an essay by a scholar named Judith Roof. And I can't remember the title of the essay itself. I think it's Size Matters. I think that's what it's called.
That's right, yeah.
Professor Roof focuses on the way liquids get used in the film. And it's a very funny and insightful essay. And suddenly, when you start reading the piece and you start seeing all the places where fluid exchange takes place in the film, you realize, oh, it is a very wet film in some ways. It's a very in some ways a disgusting film in ways that you might not have initially perceived. So I think that's the value of the essays like that, is that they draw your attention to a detail or a facet of the film that you might have overlooked. And it's not that they're making outrageous interpretive claims, but rather that they're just trying to really focus in on details and ask, what does it mean that these details recur, you know, in these patterns throughout the film? And so I think that's what I take from these essays, is the ability to kind of focus in or hone in on significant or interesting details that are easy to overlook if you're watching the film as a whole.
Yes, and I've had people say that every time they watch it again, they pick up a number of things that they missed the first time, and I think that is the case. There's a lot of layers in this film, and a lot of the essays in the book seem to revolve around castration.
Yeah, it does. I mean, what you say about the film, I think, is exactly right, and it's this, that the film repays watching it, and it reveals more of its layers of meaning or interpretive possibilities the more you watch it. So it's a film that in some ways teaches you how to watch it the more you watch it. And it's a film that in some ways repays, rewards you for doing so. As, for instance, to the castration anxiety that seems to pervade the film, or the hints of castration anxiety, you know, I guess, you know, Freud would say, well, sometimes a pair of scissors is just a pair of scissors. But when you've got somebody like Jeff Bridges running away from them after having had some kind of ferocious rodent thrown in his bathtub between his legs, it's hard not, after a couple of watchings, to start putting these details together and saying, oh, wait a minute, there's something significant about the pattern that these details are creating. I think that's exactly how this film works. And that's, again, I guess I would go back and say that's why, another reason why slacker may not be the all-encompassing term for what the film is about or the kind of people who watch it, because there is a little bit of work involved in watching this film. I mean, people mm-hmm. who are really into this film have it all memorized.
Yes, indeed.
And they can recite the lines back and forth, and they have a great deal of fun doing it. And they have really put a lot of effort into their film watching. And I know that it's easy to laugh at putting effort into film watching, but it's different than being just a couch potato or a slacker watching a film about slacker. I think the true fans, the really devoted fans of this film, have done as much work as the, you know, 45 or 50 academics who contributed essays to this book.
Right, and some of these people just have the phrases memorized, the classic phrases, and they use them in everyday conversation. I'm sure at the convention especially, but of course the most famous being "the dude abides." Mm-hmm. But there's a long list of phrases that the true fans have made part of their lives and part of their language, right?
Right, and I think that's when you know that a film has achieved cult status, is that when it has introduced a kind of code or a communication system into the culture at large.
I guess I should ask you if you're an achiever.
I'm not a member of the. I'm not an official member of the Achievers, and I suppose I would have to ask anyone who actually reads the essay to decide whether I've literally achieved anything.
Did you go to the convention in Louisville in 2006, where this idea for the book first came up?
I did not go to the convention, and I'm sorry that I missed it because a number of colleagues and friends of mine did go, and they tried their best, I think, to behave like the true devotees. Some of them are. Judith Roof, the woman I was mentioning before who wrote the essay Size Matters, presented her paper dressed as Walter. So she dressed as John Goodman playing Walter in that film, and apparently was pretty convincing in her delivery of her talk there. So it was not your typical academic convention. And as you might know, it was combined with it took place in a bowling alley.
Right.
And it was combined with one of the annual Lebowski Fests.
Flinging the F word around a lot, I suppose.
I wonder. That's something that can happen in close-knit institutional circles anyway,
there, right.
With or without the Lebowski. But I wonder if that was as liberally used in the academic conference as it is used in the film. It would be a tough standard to meet use it that often.
Craig, your essay. One of my favorite topics in the movie is the drink, the White Russian, which was the dude's drink. Jeff Bridges playing the dude. And why do you think the Coen brothers chose the White Russian as his drink?
Well, I've seen enough Coen brothers films to be wary of reading their minds about what they were intending to do or what their motivations were. But from the perspective of a viewer, I think it was the perfect choice. First, because the White Russian is kind of a precious drink, and for the listeners who aren't familiar with a White Russian, it's a blend of roughly equal parts vodka and Kahlua, with the addition of a half and half or heavy cream, and sometimes it's served on the rock, sometimes it's served straight up. But it's a sweet drink, it's easy to drink, and it has a kind of surface patina of sophistication. The word Russian in it suggests that it's somehow exotic, but it's not really a very sophisticated drink, finally. I think of it almost as the poser's drink, you know, somebody who still wants to be sort of in the retro 50s lounge lizard mode well after that era is gone. And the reason that I think it's the perfect drink is because the dude, played by Jeff Bridges in the film, is the anti-poser. If there's one thing he's not, it's a poser. He is upfront and honest about the things he does and the things he likes, and he never pretends to be something other than he is. And so why I think it's an appropriate drink is because of the way, not the drink itself, but because of the way he drinks it.
Mm.
He is so careless about the way he mixes it.
Right. I never saw that in the movie. He is careless, isn't he? If he's visiting somebody, he'll just run to the bar and just kind of slop it together, right?
He makes it with non-dairy creamer at one point.
Ooh.
I think in Maud Lebowski's house. And if you read bartending guides, and I've read a lot of them to prepare this article, and a lot of them are online, they're actually online debates about this, there are all kinds of opinions about whether you should shake it in a shaker over rocks, or whether you should shake it and then pour it over rocks, whether you should use a spoon to separate the cream from the Kahlua so you've got a layered drink, or if it should be mixed together, if the rocks should go in first or last. I mean, all kinds of different ways and all kinds of different opinions about how you make the correct White Russian. And that's another reason why it's a kind of precious poser drink. And that's another reason why it's so refreshing to see the way he drinks it, because he's going to strip any kind of posing potential out of that drink. He's going to drink it just because he likes it, because he likes the taste of it. And it's not because he cares what he looks like when he's drinking it. In fact, he often looks terrible. It gets in his beard and mustache. It looks kind of obscene, the amount of, like, shaken, you know, kind of maybe potentially not quite fresh milk that kind of accrues in his beard over the course of the film.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it I think it's easy to imagine. It would have been so simple to put a cheap beer in his hand, you know, or a kind of quintessentially American drink like whiskey, or a drink that we might associate with the Beat Generation of literary slackers, if I can use that term, like sort of cheap, you know, red table wine or something. And so I think the choice of something as precious and falsely sophisticated as the White Russian, in juxtaposition to a character like the dude, was just a really masterful choice on the part of whoever made it, either the Coen brothers or the set designer, decorator, whoever finally decided that this would be his drink of choice. I think it is as natural an extension of the dude as the vodka martini is of James Bond.
Craig Owens, a professor at Drake and a contributor to The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies. Thanks very much. I enjoyed your essay, and it gave me an excuse to watch the film again, which was always great. I appreciate the talk, the conversation. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Dennis. It's been a real pleasure.
The dude abides. We hope he abides, right?
That's right.
Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio with an archive segment about the book Olivia's Story, a very personal narrative about Mrs. Olivia Perkins, a quiet woman at the center of a history-making event, the challenge to restrictive covenants that led the way to fair and open housing in St. Louis and the rest of the country. Jonathan Aull talked to the author, Jeffrey Copeland, in January. Jeffrey Copeland is head of the English Department at the University of Northern Iowa about this fight for dignity, justice, and equality.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. The Supreme Court case Shelley versus Kramer was a landmark decision in civil rights in the United States. It made illegal restrictive covenants on property that would not allow people of color to occupy certain homes in certain neighborhoods. And while this court case is of great importance to U.S. history, the story behind the story may be even more interesting. A professor at the University of Northern Iowa has written a book about this. It's his second related to this case, and we'll explain all of that in just a moment. Jeffrey Copeland is the author of Olivia's Story and now joins us from our studios in Cedar Falls. Jeff, thanks for being on Talk of Iowa.
Well, good afternoon, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on the program.
Now, I think to get to where you ended up with Olivia's Story, you need to explain your first book a little bit and how you got those letters that kind of led you to discover this couple. So just to fill in that backstory, tell us about how you started with Inman. We'll start with that.
Well, I'd be happy to. This is every writer's dream come true, very much serendipity. If you can imagine this, I was at a flea market in Belleville, Illinois, several years ago with my relatives. I went up to one of the booths there. I found an old ratty suitcase loaded with old letters. They were tied together with twine. I opened a couple of the letters. I looked at them. Something in the voice in the letters touched me deeply. They were from a Sergeant Inman Perkins back to an Olivia Merriweather in St. Louis, Missouri. I looked at the outside of the envelope. I could see that they were written during World War II. I could also see from the envelope that Sergeant Perkins was in the 449th Colored Signal Construction Battalion of the Army Air Corps. I grew up in St. Louis, so I was interested in the history that the letters might have inside them. I never for a minute that day thought that I would write a book about this. It was just my curiosity. I've always been that kid, always curious. So I negotiated for the letters, and I actually went up to the individual selling them and said, "Sir, how much for your letters?" And he looked at me and said, "Son, you don't understand. It's the suitcase that's for sale." And I said, "No, you don't understand. I want the letters." And he said, and I'll never forget this, "No, you don't understand. If you don't buy that suitcase, you don't get the letters." So $30 later, I had 100 letters from Sergeant Perkins back to Olivia and about 30 letters from her back to him. It took me on a journey that I could never imagine in my wildest dreams. Everywhere across the United States, I ended up going to all the places where Inman's group had been stationed during World War II before they went overseas. And then I even did get to go overseas. His unit was instrumental in what happened in the European theater. So I got to do all of that. Out of that grew the book Inman's War, A Soldier's Story of Life in a Colored Battalion in World War II. It was nominated for 5 national awards, and it's currently being made into a motion picture that I hope will be out relatively soon. From that experience, while I was writing that, I realized I had a second story, a wonderful story, and this was Olivia's story. I didn't know it when I bought the letters, but Olivia was really Inman's wife. But because of a St. Louis school board ruling at the time, they had to hide their marriage because at that time, in the early 40s, women who were teachers who got married were required by Board of Education rule to give up their jobs. So they were living this elaborate ruse. Well, in doing the research for Inman's War, as I mentioned, I had this wonderful information about one of the most beautiful people I had ever read about in my life, Olivia Meriwether Perkins. So that's the connection. That's how the two books sort of fit together. No. Olivia's story is not a sequel. I call it a sort of sequel because there are common characters and events between the two.
Now, you said that you ran into a second story, but really what this book is about is the third story that you found, because just what you started to write about Olivia Perkins was not the thing you ended up finishing the book about.
That's true. I always tell writers groups, never be afraid to make what I call a hard left turn when you find out that you have a different path to go on in your writing. I started writing about Olivia's teaching career at Sumner High School, Charles Sumner High School in St. Louis, Missouri, where some of her students were Tina Turner, Chuck Berry, Arthur Ashe, and a person who's become quite a good friend of mine, Dick Gregory. And I started writing about her career there, which spanned the late 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the early 70s until she retired. She was an incredibly gifted teacher who was voted to the list of the top 100 teachers of all time. I started writing about her teaching career, and I ended up stopping. And the reason I stopped is, A, the story was about as dry as a corn cob left out in the sun. I mean, it was interesting to me, but it's one of those things you have a pretty good sense when you're not really making it for an exciting story. But I was interviewing one of Olivia's relatives to find out about her mannerisms, the way she spoke, the way she carried herself. And while I was interviewing this relative, the relative said to me, "So, are you going to write about the murder?" And I looked up and I said, I beg your pardon, what did you say? And she said, you know, the murder. And she started going through the details and explained this to me. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked because it was related to Olivia's life and her story. So it was about a month later, I'm interviewing another relative, and the relative says, "So, are you going to write about the murder?" And I started going through the details from the first relative to see if the information matched. And she looked at me and said, "Young man, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about this murder here." So it was a totally different murder that was related to the story. And then, so help me, it wasn't, but a couple months after that, I was interviewing another person who knew Olivia very well. And the person halfway through our interview said, "So, are you going to write?" And I finished the sentence, "About the murder?" And she said, "Are you?" And I said, "Yes, but I discovered," and I went through the information from the previous two. And she looked at me and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about this one." So the murders were starting to stack up like cordwood. And while the murders are not the main part of the book, they are important to what happened in the background information and how the events unfolded. So I threw away at that point everything I had written, and I started all over.
Now, I've read enough that I know that you're not too interested in giving out a lot of details about, because now we're talking about three murders, we're talking about a conspiracy, there's a lot of intrigue that's involved in here. And the way that you write the book, you really kind of leave it very open-ended, and you leave a lot hanging out there that it feels like you kind of want the reader to come to some conclusions. Why did you choose that technique?
You're very good. Okay, first of all, I chose to do narrative nonfiction and write it in the voices of the characters for what I thought was a good reason. The Shelley versus Kramer decision is one of the most important Supreme Court rulings in the history of this country. It literally changed the color of the American landscape. But if you look at the legal information, it's pretty dry. So what I wanted to do was write it in the voices of the characters so that people would have the humanity behind the story and know the sacrifices made by people that came before us to make this country the way it is today. So that's the reason why it's told the way it is. But to answer your question more specifically, I was very conscious of the fact there's no statute of limitation on murder. So I was very careful in how I presented the information in the book. To be honest with you, I think I have a pretty good idea of what happened with one of them. But it's one of those things I wanted the reader to make a judgment on what happened. So I did leave it a little more open purposely just for that reason.
Well, it felt to me also that especially we're talking about a part of American history that I'd say the vast majority of Americans wouldn't be proud of, a law that did not treat people equally. And there's this almost sense of an end justifying the means that you may be suggesting at, be it in real crimes or perceived crimes or a group of people doing something a little bit underhanded. It was that kind of in your mind as well to kind of leave it open and let people decide because of, I mean, if this was about something other than a major piece of civil rights legislation, would you have gone the same route?
You know, for most of the religions of the world that I have read about, it's wrong to take a life under any circumstances. But if a life were ever going to be taken, there were a couple of individuals involved in this story that absolutely got what they deserved. Now, I shouldn't say that out loud. I'll probably be struck by lightning on the way out of here. But I wanted people to study the events and the actions and then determine for themselves if they felt a certain course of action that took place was justified or whether maybe it wasn't just intervention of some kind.
You mentioned the ruling itself being kind of dry and wanting to give it a human voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the ruling itself, the Supreme Court actually didn't rule that the covenant was illegal. What it ruled was that the court couldn't enforce the covenant. So, which I think it may be legal mumbo jumbo, but it seemed like the court was trying to find a way to strike down the law without saying the law was illegal.
You know, you're absolutely correct. You have to remember that this time in our history, it was a political powder keg to talk about issues of equality with the races. The original suit that was brought in the St. Louis Circuit Court ruled one way, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled another way, and then when it got to the Supreme Court ruling, they actually did take sort of a dodge. They actually did say it is not illegal to create restrictive covenants, however, it is illegal to enforce them. So basically they said, sure, go ahead, you can make all the restrictions you want, but the courts are not going to support you. And in making this particular ruling, what they said was, the 14th Amendment prohibits a state from enforcing restrictive covenants, which would prohibit a person from owning or occupying property on the basis of race or color, but they did it by saying it in that way. They did it by saying, go ahead and create it. We're not going to enforce it.
Do you think there was a certain amount of foreshadowing involved in this case also? Because one of the lawyers who argued the companion case, McGee v. Sipes, which was kind of combined
right
with this one, was Thurgood Marshall, who ended up being the first African-American on the Supreme Court. Do you think that gives this case a sense of foreshadowing as well?
Incredible foreshadowing. It actually mirrors a lot of what took place in getting to Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, all the way up through the early 60s and what happened with a lot of the civil rights activities at that time. But, you know, while it's true that McGee versus Sipes was attached to this at the Supreme Court, there was actually another case that most people simply don't know about that took place in Washington, D.C., that involved a gentleman of Native American descent who was denied occupation of a piece of property there because he was Native American. So it wasn't just an issue of African American and Caucasian. There were several other pieces that were thrown in at the same time.
Now, we've talked the last few minutes here, we've been talking about a little more of the hard history of it. Your book is, it certainly reads like a novel. You said some things were modified and compressed a little bit, some names were changed. Is this a piece of fiction or is this nonfiction?
No, it's nonfiction. It's narrative nonfiction. Narrative nonfiction is a type of writing whereby all the major facts and events are true, but the author is allowed to flesh out the original situation with this case. The original suit was brought in St. Louis Circuit Court by Fernand Lewis Kramer in October of 1945, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling wasn't until 1948. So to make it a more focused narrative and to have the flow better, I compressed some of the time. But each one of the events in the story is true. So it is absolute nonfiction. But what the characters say at a given time, whether it be at an event or a party or something like that, I had to flesh out. But here's the toughest part of writing narrative nonfiction. For every character in the story, I interviewed people who were either relatives of theirs or people who knew them quite well or both to find out different things like, you know, what they said, how they said it, how they dressed, their motives, things like that. So I had a very good feel for what the characters were like. So even in writing dialogue for the characters, I felt I had from the other information a very good handle on it.
Let's give the listeners a flavor of what this book reads like. Can you read a passage? And maybe before you do, just kind of explain whose voice you wrote the book in, and so we have a little bit of backstory on where we are at this point in the book.
Thank you. I'd be happy to. This is Olivia's voice. When the five, I'll call them co-conspirators, or conspirators, got together to make the plan to purchase the property on Labadee Avenue, we can talk about that in a minute. When they all got together, they talked over a little bit about the plan, and these were Olivia's thoughts as this was all explained to her, what they were going to do. This is in the chapter called Covenants. I didn't have to think long about this, not at all. I knew what many of the consequences could be if we were caught, but at the same time, I also knew what this could mean if we were successful. If everything fell as planned, we'd be able to put at least a small hole in the invisible fence surrounding the ville. The Shelleys were just one family, but if we could stop, at least temporarily, the advance of the mission of the real estate exchange, we might be able to open doors to possibilities none of us thought would ever be possible in our lifetimes. It would be risky, very risky. But it was also a risk I felt worth taking, one that had to be taken. I looked at the others, and I saw it in their eyes as well. Suddenly, from deep in my heart, I knew there was only one thing to say. I'm in, I said to the group. I know I should probably ask a million questions, but I'm not going to. I've heard enough for now. There's only one question I want answered before we leave today. What's our first step? And that's a scene where, as I mentioned, the conspirators get together. They talk about the plan of action they're going to do. This provided the foundation for Shelley versus Kramer.
That's Jeff Copeland reading from Olivia's story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley v. Kramer, which is published by Paragon House. Now, Jeff, that isn't William Ambrose, and that's certainly not Doris Kearns Goodwin. So if someone is a student of U.S. history, why should they take this narrative fiction to heart, and how do you believe that while we understand the research that you've done into it, your own personal writing style, your own personal interpretation is certainly in there. How does that play into a student of history wanting to know more?
Sure. As I mentioned, this really started taking place in 1945, so we're talking over 60 years ago. Most of the principals involved in the story are well into their 80s. Some are in their 90s, and some have passed on. It's the dignity possessed by the individuals in these stories that is often the forgotten part of history.
Jeff Copeland is the author of Olivia's Story, The Conspiracy of Heroes Behind Shelley v. Kramer. It is published by Paragon House Publishers. Jeff Copeland is the professor and head of the Department of English and Literature at the University of Northern Iowa. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, that book is called Olivia's Story by Jeffrey Copeland of the University of Northern Iowa. That was Jonathan Aull with that interview from the archives from January of this year.